Blog Talk Radio.
Original 18th century Romantic movement in arts and philosophy as a spiritual and intellectual rebellion against the dehumanizing aspects of the Industrial Revolution. Carrying this on through the Victorian age of what we now reprise as steampunk Romanticism, to the death of all the dreams and visions of beauty in the depressing horror of World War I. And then the cynical, jaded pseudo-romanticism of the lost generation, typified by Aleister Crowley's Visions of Decadence. We will explain what romanticism is and how Nazis and Bolsheviks and devout Christians can all be equally romantic. We will look at the Faustian archetype, the Luciferian idea, Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and the little understood philosophy of solipsism, so important to the hermetic individuation process. As I said, this is going to be a feast of ideas, so stay tuned and savor the mind food. Now, back in 1970-71, when we were first getting started at the OTA, we hung some rather garish and very mysterious-looking posters all around the USC campus. We stapled them on every telephone pole around the USC campus and stuck them on the bulletin boards and said that the magicians walked among you, and we have, you can see this on our Hermetic Associate Members website. You can see this poster that we had with this magician with a hood holding up a wand and a horned altar and all this, and smoke rising, whatever. and Robert Elwood, doctor, professor who taught comparative religion at USC, was absolutely fascinated by this and very quickly got in touch with us and even covered us in his landmark book, a book called Religious and Spiritual Groups in Modern America. And this book's been through several editions and printings. And we're featured in the book, the OTA was. And we lectured at some of Robert Elwood's classes, and Robert Elwood ended up doing one of his papers that he delivered on us at a symposium over in Italy. He ended up being published in our seasonal ceremony book. Now, what I'm getting to about that is this: in Religious and Spiritual Groups in Modern America, Robert Elwood suggested very strongly that the neo-pagan movement That was the witchcraft movement that was just getting going. He started, and Farfaria and the OTA, magic, ceremonial magic, that this was a new version of Romanticism, a return of Romanticism. And Bob Elwood made a very strong point about this. And I was so impressed by this that when I finally got toward my master's degree in cultural anthropology, I used Elwood's idea as a basis of my thesis. I was going to prove, and in 60,000 words, I was going to try to prove that the revival of magic and neo-paganism was an expression of a revitalization movement, to use Anthony Wallace's term, and that it was neo-romantic. It was a new form of romanticism. This was, of course, Bob's original idea. Well, after 60,000 pages and all, my committee agreed to give me a master's degree based on that. So that, of course, a lot of other work. But still, the point that Bob Elwood was trying to make, and the point that I was carrying forward with my master's thesis, is a very important point in understanding both the neo-pagan expression and ceremonial magic, the rebirth of ceremonial magic, which has been, by the way, reborn several times. But each time it's been reborn, it's been in this romantic context. So we need to understand, in order to understand this psychological and philosophical mechanism here, we need to understand just what Bob Elwood meant by the romantic movement and what we mean by the neo-romantic movement. And I'm going to try to do that and try to make it as interesting as possible. And it's relevant to today because it is. It's very, very relevant to. In fact, it's probably more relevant today than at any time in its 300-year history. So Romanticism is a not just a philosophy, although Romanticism is the philosophical term for it. Romanticism is an outlook. Romanticism is a personal approach to life. It is a mindset. And not only is it a mindset, it's a heart set. And what I mean by this is this. The basic tenet of Romanticism is follow your heart. This is at the essence of it, is your sympathies, your emotions, your empathy, your feelings. These are what you should follow, and these are what you should do. What it is that you really feel that you want to do, that which you love the most, that's what you should do. This is the romantic point of view. The romantic is a person who is in sympathy. And that sympathy can go in various different ways. Now, this is an important point. A lot of people who don't quite understand romanticism, they think that, oh, well, all romantics are all reactionaries, and they want to bring back the king, and they want to go back to the gold standard, and they want to go back to the horse and buggy and all. No. Actually, this is not necessarily true. There is a lot of nostalgia involved, and very selective nostalgia involved in romanticism, and we'll get into that. I want to insist now that you understand that romanticism is not specifically reactionary. It isn't. Romantics can be just as far on the left politically and they could be to the left. And the more romantic they are, the further to the left they're going to be. And the more romantic they are, the further to the right they're going to be. They can, you could have, there was an element of romanticism in Nazism, very definitely. And there was also, conversely, there was an element of romanticism in Bolshevism, in communism. Oh, yeah. I mean, this was the good fight. This was the great cause. This was bigger than life. This was something that, you know, romanticism is the path of the heart. Now, how did it get started, and when did it get started? Well, the truth is, we've always, the human mechanism behind romanticism has always been with us. And we've always had people who we would now term romantic. But back in, before the Industrial Revolution, before the egalitarian age, before these various social revolutions, before that time, society was very, very, very structured. And you had the clergy, and you had the nobility, and you had the peasants in the Middle Ages, and that was it. And if you were a peasant, you were a peasant, and you might be a good peasant, but you were still a peasant. And you would be very, very, very fortunate if you ever got to be anything but a peasant. And then the nobility, they were all born into what they were doing, so they were, and they did, and they felt that was their due. So they were in a satisfied situation. And the clergy, of course, that was what they did, and they ran the spiritual end of it. And so people were, if they weren't satisfied with their lot, at least they thought they were supposed to be satisfied with their lot. So we can't say that romanticism really was going on in the Middle Ages. And curiously enough, of course, the romantics of a later era have romanticized the Middle Ages, and yet the Middle Ages, the people in the Middle Ages themselves were not romantic, and if they were, they tried not to be. Anyway, where romanticism gets started is when we start breaking down in the early days of the Industrial Revolution and in the 18th century, that's the 1700s, we start in the middle 1700s, we really start breaking down the barriers in society. People at this point, the commercial class was getting to be basically the largest class, the commercial either labor or mercantile class. And they, in the Middle Ages, they never quite knew what to do with the merchant class. They were sort of non-entities, and they did what they did, but nobody had a place for them. But in this period where the Enlightenment, a number of things are happening. Religion's being questioned, and it's being depowered, and that frees people to do a lot of individual thinking and whatever. We're breaking down these class structures. There is a movement toward egalitarian, toward the idea that all men are essentially, ought to have the same chance in life, and this is going on all over Europe, and of course in the United States, and in a way where what was colonial here at that time, and you get a new outlook for people, at least for Europeans and Americans. You get this new outlook. This new outlook is, hey, what am I going to do? What am I going to do in my life? What should I do? What should I want? Where should I go? What should I believe in? All of this is up for grabs. And this, although it's good in the one hand that we're freeing people from all this, you know, stuff, on the other hand, it creates a lot of dissatisfaction. And people once people realize that they're not bound by all these superstitions and traditions and whatever, they begin to look at the world, and they begin to get dissatisfied, and they begin to
think, well, gee, I think I want to do something better with my life. Now,
there's a certain type of person. No matter what, no matter how free society is or whatever, there's a certain type of person who just is going to do what most people expect that person to do, and they're going to just carry on their life, and they're satisfied with whatever they can get and whatever. But really, once people are given a chance at upward mobility, once they are freed from their shackles or superstition, more or less, about almost 50% of human beings, adults, or the time they get to be adults, they have ambitions and they have desires to improve themselves. They question, at least as high as 50% of the people are that way. They want to get ahead. They want to be the masters of their own life. They like to be. And that is where, from that large pool, is where our romantics come from. Now, the romantics were people, and a lot of them were very well educated. In fact, most of them that would call themselves romantics or knew how to call themselves romantics were very talented, very well educated, creative people. And they looked around at this industrial revolution that was getting started, and this, and they just, they really realized that it was, sure, we're making a lot of products for people, and in some ways life is improving. But they also saw the dehumanization and the horror of it. Because when the Industrial Revolution got started, and it did, it got started way back in the 18th century. This is when it started. And this is when the mills and the shops and the foundries, and this is when they got started. And this is when the cities began to grow, and you get the squalor in the cities, and you get and it grew, and the old traditions were withering away or dying, and people were questioning, and they were looking at all of this, and they were dissatisfied. And of course, we had, as you remember, the French Revolution was a horrible example of the disparity between the aristocrats, some of whom were romantics, the aristocrats and with their fabulous wealth and the poor who were absolutely miserable, and this became an explosion. But there's a romantic element even in the French Revolution. And, Rousseau, Rousseau is credited with being one of the progenitors of what eventually became Bolshevism and what eventually became socialism. But Rousseau was a romantic. He extolled the noble savage, use Andre's expression, the beauty of the primitive, and the idea that the savage out in the jungle is really much more of a noble person than the poor factory worker or the mill worker, Of course, this is not true at all. Savages or so-called savages are more hidebound by tradition, and they have more taboos and more inhibiting customs than any Frenchman in that period had. But still, that didn't bother Rousseau. He idealized it. Well, this is what the Romantics did, not just with the noble savage, but also with King Arthur and his knights, Oh, how wonderful that was, how beautiful, how glorious. We fight the good fight, and and everything. You have all the armor is nice and shiny, and all the ladies are in these beautiful gowns, and everybody, even though we have, you know, romantic love and passion and all of that, but still, it's all done with elegance and style. And of course, as I'm sure we all realize, and even they realize themselves, the romantics realize it, the Dark Ages were not that way. The Dark Ages were not that way at all. And probably King Arthur, even though if there ever was a King Arthur, he probably ate with his fingers But still, they yearned. They yearned for beauty. They yearned for something better. They yearned for the romantic yearns for a human perfection. Now, there's several different types here of romantics operating. Some romantics identify with the whole human race. They do. They're kind of a Christian way of looking at it. They say, "Oh, well, you know, we're all sinners. We're all human beings. We're all beautiful, and we are." And they would identify with the whole human race, and then they would want to create some utopian system. And that, of course, could translate into something pretty terrible, actually, in actual fact. But it was always an ideal. And then some romantics didn't like people at all, and yet they were still romantic. They believed that they were superior to everybody, and only they really had the destiny, and they didn't like people, but they were still romantic because they believed that they were going to do these great things, and they were going to. So you have almost a. In a sense, you have different poles of romanticism, and you have the Faustian archetype of the sorcerer Faust, who summons up the demon and sells his soul to the devil and all of this kind of. This is romantic. Even though you might say it's diabolic, you might say it's evil. Well, you know. I hate to say it, but there's a romanticism in Nazism, and Hitler used to cry. He'd break down and cry at Wagnerian operas, and go out without food for a couple of days so he could afford a ticket. And of course, then he had a crush on Wagner's granddaughter too. But I mean, you know, a romantic. Can be a prince of evil. You can be, but romanticism is that spirit, that human spirit where the human being wants perfection. He or she wants it for everybody, or wants it just for themselves, or wants it, but whatever it is, it's the path of the heart, and it is the path of perfection. And there is a great nostalgia for the mythical past, because this becomes a model. Let me give you an example of that. Camelot, all right? Not just the musical Camelot, but Mallory's Camelot. The whole Middle Ages romanticized Camelot, even while they were, you know, right in the middle of the Middle Ages, even von Eschenbach. You know what? Von Eschenbach was a jock. Von Eschenbach was a professional knight. He was a jousting champion. He was going all over Europe making his money, knocking people off of their horses. And he wrote one of the great Grail romances. Yeah, the Parsifal. And that was set in this earlier time where King Arthur had the Grail and it was all beauty and all of that. So even in the Middle Ages they were romanticizing the Dark Ages. Now, I said that our neo-pagan movement started off, of course, over here with Farfaria and and well, and the Gardnerians came in, and of course the LTA got started pretty shortly thereon, and Golden Dawn got revived. The OTO finally got itself, picked up itself and started again, and this was a very definitely a resurgence of Romanticism. And magic, of course, is the quintessence of Romanticism, because the magical attitude, the Hermetic attitude, is that the individual is the center of the universe, and the individual is a miniature of the universe, and the individual can get in direct contact with God, and can manipulate both his universe within and, conversely, manipulate the universe without. And this, of course, is the Hermetic proposition, which is supremely romantic. Yeah, this is supremely romantic, either for good or for evil or for whatever you want to say. This is supremely romantic. Now, I was so impressed with this that I with Bob Elwood's idea, and I went ahead and did my thesis based on that. And of course, I was developing the OTA at the time. Fred Adams agreed with me, and so did Ed Fitch of the Gardnerians, and Fred Adams of Fair Ferry. We all agreed, and we got together and we tried to see if we couldn't. Codify and launch a neo-romantic movement. In other words, could we gather these romantic expressions under one head, and could we get people to realize that even though it's your Golden Dawn, and you don't like the witches, but the witches don't like the OTA because that's part of ceremonial magic, and the people in the Ren Faire don't like the pagans because they don't want to have anything to do with any kind of rituals, but they do want to replicate the Middle Ages. And then there are all these other groups that are doing these nostalgic things, like the science fiction community and the people who are having science fiction groups and conventions, whatever. Can we get all of these together under the heading of a neo-romantic movement? Well, we couldn't do it. We tried. We did try. I published in the Seventh Ray, where we only had a circulation about 300. I published a couple of articles, one of which I will read a little bit of. And we couldn't get this thing to catch on. One of the reasons why we couldn't is because Romanticism, as a result of the Nazi, the Romanticism that was obvious and the Nazi thing, Romanticism had become a kind of a dirty word. And you might say, in a way, that after World War II, that the whole romantic proposition was almost, in a sense, suppressed. The science fiction and fantasy in those days was, the only place you could get it were these grubby pulp magazines, these gaudy covers, and nobody gave any credence to the darn things. They were just sort of the next step up from a comic book. And the science fiction community was struggling to get some kind of recognition. And I know this sounds strange, but it really did happen. See, Adlerian psychology was almost the national standard at that time. And Adler's idea of maturity was submit and adjust and realize your limitations. That was how Adler viewed a mature adult. That was the national standard, was Adlerian psychology. And believe it or not, public libraries were systematically removing from public libraries the Oz books, the Burroughs books, and even Grimm's fairy tales were being removed from the children's section of public libraries all over the country. This was happening in the 1950s. Submit and adjust. There were articles, serious articles published by sociologists and all, where they were advising against children being brought up on fairy tales, brought up on heroic myths and this sort of thing. You're advising against it. Now, this was, frankly, anti-romantic. And romanticism became a dirty word. Remember now I said that you can be, romantics can be right wing, they can be left wing, and they can be as radical as, you know, on both ends. But just to give you an example, Newt Gingrich, who's pretty conservative, was accused of being a romantic. Yeah, it is a derogatory term applied to him. So there was a kind of a national national crusade against romanticism, and I don't think it was all motivated by my anti-Nazism. I don't think that was it, but that's what kicked it off. But I think the reason for it was that we were moving toward an educational system in which we would try to adjust children to what we considered to be proper society. 1950s was a very, very button-down, controlled era. They had in those days, believe it or not, all high school students had to take a psychology profile test nationwide to judge how well they adapted to other students, how well they adapted to. And this was the start of the national dossier system. So we were moving toward, believe it or not, we were moving toward something like what they had in Russia. This is what we were moving toward. And this, of course, is very, very anti-romantic. Yeah, Hitler may have been a romantic, but Stalin certainly was not. Anyway, what broke this were two things. Two things broke this: the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War. Both of those events broke this tremendously oppressive 1950s drift toward institutional conformity. And the civil rights movement broke it because if you have psychological profiles on students, that discriminates against the students, and you can't have it. So that was the end of that. The national dossier system ended right there. Bam! That was the end of it. We're going back to it now, of course. Now Google is the national dossier system, so I guess we're going to have it back anyway. But the other thing that broke it, of course, was the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War brought on the psychedelic era, and the psychedelic era, that was very romantic. I mean, good gosh, these are about as romantic as you can get. And it was a wonderful expression of romanticism. And then something happened that I just think the impact of it has not been realized, and I this is going to surprise you, but one of the things that really broke the dam and reestablished romanticism was Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring. This hit like a thunderbolt. The Fellowship of the Ring, the Ring trilogy, it first showed up. Ace Books ran off a pirated edition in New York. That sold out. They went through four or five printings, and then the authorized editions came out. Millions of people were starved for fairy tales. They were starved for romantic, for myths. They were starved for the books that had been taken out of the libraries. We had this period of we weren't supposed to think about heroes. We weren't supposed to think about kids aren't supposed to. They're just supposed to keep their nose to the grindstone and do what their folks tell them and all this kind of. So, J.R.R. Tolkien, bless his heart, was really in many, many ways responsible for giving us back our romantic heritage. And this just opened up a whole floodgate of heroic literature and of course films, and so we began to recover the idea of a life that was glorious and heroic and its expression. But the powers that be, of course, whoever those powers are, I haven't figured out who they are yet, but the powers that be, them, all right? If you know who they are, you're one of them. If you don't know who they are, you're one of us. Well, okay, but anyway, they decided that they couldn't put the genie back in the bottle. Tolkien was out, and people were reading it, and people were memorizing it, and people were making a religion out of it, and you had a rebirth of romanticism and of course the SCA got going and the Ren Fairs got going and meanwhile our neo-pagan movement is going and magic is reviving, and so we are returning to, and all this gets hooked up with, guess what? The Save the Earth movement. Let's get this pollution under control. Let's preserve nature. Yeah, and that sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Because that was what kicked off, one of the big things that kicked off the Romantic movement back 150 years earlier. Was all of the awful pollution and the awful conditions of the Industrial Revolution. God, if you think the smog in Los Angeles was bad, you have no idea what it was like in London in the 1880s. Oh, ho, ho. So we have this neo-romantic movement. And whether or not we can put it all together and realize it's neo-romantic or not, we tried to do that. But here again, how do you get a bunch of romantics together really to agree on anything? It's kind of difficult. It's like they say about Frenchmen. If you get one Frenchman, you got a political party. You get two Frenchmen, you got two political parties, and you get three of them, and then you got a government. Three different, and they're all three different political parties. And so, getting a romantic movement together that had one particular thrust was seems like not a doable thing, and yet on the other hand, the characteristics of today's romantics, they do share some characteristic approaches. And one of those approaches is most of today's romantics really are concerned about the condition of nature and the earth, and they're concerned about preserving our little wilderness we have left. Most of them are, and most romantics these days are not anti-technological, but they don't want technology to rule their lives. They want to preserve their freedoms. Most romantics are very fiercely individualistic, and they want to retain their freedoms, and they want to fight the good fight and cure the ills of society, but at the same time, they don't want to lose their liberty. And so there are certain characteristics in romanticism that I think most of them share. Now, in actual fact, romantics, of course, can be, romanticism can be hooked up to almost any fanatical cause. On the really dark side, you could say that Japanese samurai were certainly romantic, and yet one of the most popular stories in Japan is you won't ever see over here in this country, because they've made a movie out of it 5 times in Japan, but you won't ever see it over here, is when it's called the 40 Loyal Retainers, and this is when all 40 of the servants of the samurai who feels compelled to commit suicide, so all of his 40 retainers they all commit suicide in his honor, and this is a very, very popular story in Japan. Well, this is romantic. Yeah, it sounds like it's crazy, but it is. It's romantic. So there's a side to, and I'm not going to, and I know what you're thinking, but I hate to credit Al Qaeda with romanticism, but then unfortunately, I think probably by our definition, yes, I think some of them probably are. So the romanticism is not necessarily all for the good, but romanticism is what it is. And it is, the romantic believes that life should be lived in whatever way the romantic chooses to live it, whether as a monk, whether as a warrior, whether as a priest, a saint, or a monster. The romantic's going to live it to the fullest, and he's going to put everything he or she has into it. And this is the philosophy. Also, it hooks up with, and this is the magical part of it, it goes and walks hand in hand with the Hermetic proposition. And the Hermetic proposition can be termed in philosophical terms, can be called a mystical form of solipsism. And what I mean by solipsism is that you are the center of the universe, and your consciousness, the fact that you are the experiencer of your consciousness. Nobody else is. Nobody else has got your consciousness. You're the one that's got it. So you ask yourself the question at some point in your life, why am I me? And a little voice answers, you are you because you are very special. And you have something to do. And you better find what it is and you better do it. So that is the phenomenon of solipsism, or what was referred to in psychological terms as the oceanic sense. And quite frankly, Freud was afraid of it. He knew about it, but he was afraid of it. Now, only children, especially if they're lonely only children, can get into this a lot easier than kids that grow up with brothers and sisters and a lot of competition between the brothers and sisters. It's kind of hard to, it's kind of hard to sit and think about, to wonder why you are you when you got, when you're fighting with your brothers and sisters. But when you're a lonely only child, this can occur to you, and it can occur to you later on in life, even if you did have brothers and sisters. And when it does occur to you, and you begin to realize the significance of it, then you're on the road to, if you follow that path, you're on the road to discovering just what the meaning of your consciousness is. And this is part and parcel of the romantic process, because most, I think you can define romanticism is by the idea that the individual person, the individual romantic, is very much aware of his or her own individual self, and is concerned about what it is that that individual is supposed to do, and what it is, how they're supposed to do, what they're supposed to believe, and how they're supposed to do it, and then they do this from a standpoint of feelings and intuition, and they do it. Aleister Crowley was certainly a romantic. He was one of those romantics that didn't like people. He thought he was smarter than everybody else, and there were very, very few people that he liked. Howard Hughes is another example of that. Howard Hughes was a romantic, absolutely, and just as romantic as Crowley, and just as magical as Crowley in a lot of ways. And Howard Hughes said, well, I like things better than people. Yeah, so a romantic doesn't have to be a great people lover. Or, on the other hand, a romantic can be a saint, and he can love other people more than himself, and still be very much aware of his own personal destiny. And so, if you go either way, I think personally that regardless of whether you basically like people or not, that it's a very good idea to realize that everybody else really is, even if they may be figments of your great imagination, still those figments, a lot of them are smarter than you are, and just as good as you are, and just as maybe even more spiritual than you are. And so you should give them all deference until they give you any reason not to give them deference. That's my personal feeling. I finally got to the point, when I was a teenager, I don't think I liked people very much, but finally, after I finally grew up, I realized, oh, yeah, I do like people. I do. But I also have sympathy for those who don't like people. And yet, I think that you can safely say that romantics are people who are very much aware of their own individuality. And they're very much aware of that, and they do, most of them, almost all of the romantics, believe that there really is something they're supposed to do. Even if they think that fate's ordained it or whatever, there's something they've got to do. And they're going to do it, and they're going to do it well. And that characterizes the whole aspect of it. Now, I'd like to read just a little bit of this article. I did two articles in the Seventh Ray, in the old Seventh Ray, on neo-romanticism. And one of them, the second one, I got the old Seventh Ray book here and I'm flipping through it. And the second article was more detailed than the first. I'm trying to locate it here. Yeah, here it is. The philosophy of neo-romanticism. And I said, 3 years ago in volume two, number two of the Seventh Ray, this, by the way, was written in 77, I presented an editorial called Magic and the Neo-Romantic Movement. And although it was something less than a manifesto, it did make the assertion that the current occult neo-pagan revival was the spiritual core of a broad-based neo-romantic movement which had dawned on the American cultural horizon. Now, after 3 years of deteriorating socioeconomic conditions, accompanied by political and cultural beliefs, because we were going through another recession at that time, I can at least report that we, occultists and neo-pagans, are solidly entrenched and that our hardier breed of romanticism is still viable, and we have had setbacks on the popular front, but this was inevitable under the circumstances. Now, 5 years ago, the sociologist Marcello Ruzzi differentiated the various areas of the occult revival, such as occultism, witchcraft, and Satanism, astrology, and etc., reserving the final ashcan category for the UFOs and psychic phenomenon. And sadly enough, the contents of Ruzzi's trash bin have recently been elevated by popular demand to the number one position. And the reason seems to be that intelligent, imaginative, and creative people, in effect potential neo-romantics and neo-pagans, no longer have much time to indulge in the pursuit of fads, and they are too busy to survive. And we must admit that pop witchcraft in the late 1960s and early 70s was just what the term implied, a fad, albeit a romantic one. And without significant numbers of culturally advantaged dilettantes shopping in the fad market, the rising popularity of UFO cargo cultism is easy to understand. Now, I was being very cynical because it is also true, and this is one of the things that I wanted to discuss about all of this, that there is a difference, I think, a difference between irrational fad pop culture. UFO cultism and pop culture witchcraft, and the serious application of magic and pagan traditions as an art form, as something spiritually significant, something that elevates your spirit, something that is grand and eloquent. That is supremely romantic. And unfortunately, and I'll admit that I kind of like Pulp Fiction, and I kind of like pop culture to some extent. I do, and I was nurtured on it when I was a kid, along with the classics and mythology and all that. So I have a warm spot in my heart for pop culture, but then we pagan and magical romantics, we need to strive for the elegant. We need to strive for that which is marvelously and beautifully significant, and try to avoid, if we can, appealing to the, to the popular fringe. I think in this way, of course, I know that there are especially in the Hollywood crowd, they look at occultism and witchcraft as something spooky and horrific,
and they want to emphasize those aspects of it. And of course, it does have, you know, it has some aspects of that. Dracula is very romantic, and you know, and there's a dark, and this whole gothic thing is very romantic, and all of this is romantic. But what I'm suggesting is, let us do it with style. Let us do it with flair. Let us do it with style. If you're going to be dark and sinister, then for heaven's sake, read Kenneth Grant and aspire to the art of Austin Spare. And do it this way. In remembering the words of Nero in Quo Vadis, I think he said, "Let it be wonderful or let it be terrible, so long as it is uncommon." As long as it is done with style and flair. And as long as, because nothing embarrasses me more than the crude and the crass and the ludicrous. And so, as I say, magic, angels and demons and all, and we'll storm the gates of heaven and we'll harrow the depths of hell, but for heaven's sake, let's do it elegantly and with a style. And always remembering that magic is the art of kings. Now, next week, we will see if we can't find ourselves a guest who is a bit romantic. And we'll see you then again next week. And don't forget to next week, let's have some call-ins and maybe some comments on this show, too, if you'd like. And we'll see you again. And meanwhile, good magic.